Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. I'd like to welcome today Brian Hardgrove. He's the band leader for the group Public Enemy. He's the leader and producer of Fine Arts Militia and a new band called The Band. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And Brian will be taking part in a panel discussion tomorrow, Friday, the 23rd of February at 7 o'clock at the College of Santa Fe, the forum over there. It's a hip-hop panel entitled Gender, Race, and the New Power Base, the Hip-Hop Generation and Contemporary Politics, that is free and open to the public. That's tomorrow night. So let's start talking about hip-hop. And you're in a town that maybe has a lot of hip-hop, but certainly is not the epicenter of hip-hop culture in the world, right, in the United States. What is hip-hop? What are its musical and political roots?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's loaded in some cases, depending on who you ask. There's a real move towards revisionist history of hip-hop across the world. You know, when James Brown died recently, a lot of the media credited James Brown with hip-hop generally. James has always credited himself with that, with rap, you know, with being the originator of rap, and there's a lot of validity there. But when you talk to some of the most current artists, and the most popular artists, they'll tell you different things. Like one of my good friends, Johnny Juice, is one of the original DJs for Public Enemy, and one of the current producers of Public Enemy. He'll give you a long history of hip-hop. Based on things that have happened in the world, things that have happened in New York. That,
for example?
Well, you'd have to ask him, but he'll talk about, say, a Kool Herc, who is one of the founders that everybody recognizes. He's one of the founders of hip-hop from New York, and he did not get a lot of credit when, say, groups like Grandmaster Flash got big. You know, you didn't talk about people like Kool Herc, but Johnny Juice would know all that kind of stuff. Today, like some of the bigger artists like 50 Cent or groups like that, they may not know that kind of history. So then they'll tell you that the origins of hip-hop are this. The political power of hip-hop is this, or the political message of hip-hop is that. And so it really depends on who you ask, you know. And I'm not a hip-hop historian myself. You know, I've been doing music way before hip-hop even became popular, you know, and I wasn't a big fan of it in the beginning.
Is that right?
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan. I'm still a musician. A lot of hip-hop players hate musicians. A lot of hip-hop artists don't really appreciate musicians. So I didn't really get into it really until Public Enemy came on the scene.
Now, how did you come to join Public Enemy?
Long story, I'll make it short. Chuck D had his own label with Sony some years back, and one of his artists named Kyle Jason sought out some help for a tour he was doing. He called me. I met Chuck through him. Chuck saw how I operated in Kyle's band. Kyle wasn't a rapper, he was a singer. So how I operated, and one thing led to the next, and when Chuck wanted a band for Public Enemy, he asked me to come on board and be the band leader.
Now let's talk for a moment about Public Enemy. I mean, you're the band leader. It was going on for quite a while before you joined. Mm-hmm. What is it all about musically and politically?
Musically, it's a lot of folks call it organized noise, musically. It's a very well thought out musical palette. It's very powerful.
Now, when you say you say organized noise, do you buy that, or are you just saying
no,
some people make it derogatory?
No. Some people have called it that way. Have called it that in a derogatory way, and other people have called it that because they didn't know what else to call it. They just bought that, but they like it. It's very well thought out. It was put together by a couple of musicians, actually. And so they broke a lot of ground, broke a lot of musical rules. So musically, it's essentially what a rock band is. That's what Public Enemy is musically. Politically, it's all the obvious things you hear. It's some people read the messages as anti-this or anti-that, and they're really not that.
Maybe some people listening really don't know Public Enemy's music that well. Mm-hmm. So what's it all about? What kind of messages have they been about since the beginning?
Well, the biggest song is a song called Fight the Power from the Spike Lee movie Do the Right Thing. That's that is a very typical Public Enemy song. It's sort of anti-establishment, you know. There were a couple of famous lines in it where they were criticizing the images of, say, John Wayne or whomever that were being pushed on everybody. But from the perspective of young black people, particularly up in New York, which is what they represented and still represent in a lot of ways, John Wayne didn't mean anything to them, you know, or to us. So it was talking about what means anything to us. That's what Public Enemy was about. And anti-establishment, not for the sake of it, but just around issues that mattered to young black people, you know, at that time and still. And now, the biggest audience for Public Enemy really is young white folks. You know, the black audience for Public Enemy has dropped off significantly because a lot of young black folks listen to music that they're pretty much told to listen to by corporate radio. You know, and I guess a lot of non-black people are like that as well. But the big fan base around the world for PE is mostly everyone else.
Very interesting. Now, when you have a message about Fight the Power, when you have a message that is really about black experience, a black audience, what are white suburban teenagers in the Midwest getting out of it?
Well, because Chuck told the story from a black perspective, but for the most part, it talked about disenfranchised people, disenfranchised youth. So that's why it resonates around the world. You know, it's Dick Clark said it best about James Brown's hit "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud." He said, "Well, that song was a big hit because everyone can relate to that." You know, he said, "It could be say it loud, I'm black and I'm Polish. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm Jewish. It didn't matter."
Right.
You know, so the same thing applies here. It's about what youth doesn't get out of societies at large. In some cases, well, in the case of the States. And just being disenfranchised generally. You know.
And being disenfranchised around what? A sense of identity, a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose?
Probably all of those things. I mean, you know, with PE, like I said, from the black perspective, it was not having jobs, not having access to opportunity. So, like I said, Chuck expressed those things from the black perspective, but that affects everybody. Not have, you know, lack of jobs, lack of opportunity. That affects everyone. That's not a black thing. You know, that's not exclusive.
That's
to
a
any.
Class thing.
It's a class thing. You know. Yeah, it happens around the world. You
know. Now, as a member of Public Enemy, I mean, huge audience over many years. What kind of effect have you actually seen the music having on people's lives?
Well, Public Enemy shows are the most peaceful shows that I've ever attended. And I never saw the group before I started playing with the group. I had the records. I was a big fan and still am. But I'd never seen the group. And I've been to, I couldn't tell you how many concerts I've been to. The impact of their music is such that people feel hope, you know. We've done shows where there are skinheads at the shows who clearly might be more aggressive in another environment, but at a Public Enemy show, they feel like they belong to something, and they feel like the group speaks to their needs. And you'll see someone like Chuck raise a fist in defiance or talk about black issues at the shows, but the fans will know he's not talking against them. He's talking about things from his perspective that are good for everybody. You know, if I'm not free, nobody's free. You know, that's pretty much what he tells people. So I think the audience is getting a sense of hope, you know, in a lot of ways from what Chuck is saying.
Now, we're talking to Brian Hardgrove, the band leader of Public Enemy. So concerts, Public Enemy concerts, are plays, I mean, they can be very large, thousands, tens of thousands of people, where, I mean, I've gone to a lot of concerts myself in many different genres, and I've noticed that there are concerts where something happens that I call the magic, and then some concerts where that doesn't happen. When that magic happens, what do people take, I mean, it's an experience in itself, but then what do they take out the next day, the next week, into their lives?
Well, from a Public Enemy show, you'd have to ask the people who go to the shows, because I'm part of the show, you know.
But you must get feedback from fans.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, you know, you get the pretty typical, I think, well, Public Enemy changed my life. We met one guy, in Serbia last year, I think it was, who said, I learned to speak English because of Public Enemy records. You know, he knew something was going on, and he's learned to speak English.
It would be interesting to see what his vocabulary is.
Yeah, right. But actually, his English was quite good, you know. What they take away from it, I think it's different for everybody. I hear a lot of the same thing about how it changed my life. You know, no one is saying this. You know, it's such a blessing that you guys are still doing it. What have you been doing? When are you coming back? Because P.E. hasn't had a big record in a long time. They've been constantly making records, but hasn't had a big hit, you know, for a number of years. So sometimes when P.E. shows up in a country like Serbia or where some other former, you know, Soviet satellite country, they didn't realize that the band was still operating, you know. So it's very, very exciting for folks to see the band. It's very hopeful. People feel very hopeful, you know. Chuck is a really lovable guy. He knows what he's talking about. He knows what's important to him. And he keeps people around him who are that way, for the most part, who are that way. And I like to think that's why I got the job, to run that, you know, run that band. So, you know, the audience is very appreciative and very passionate.
Now, you're a bass player. Mm-hmm. What's your origins in music? How'd you get started playing bass, playing music?
Another long story, and I'll keep it short. I wanted to be a policeman when I was a kid. And
now you're from New York City.
New York, yeah. And just before my junior high school years, I won tickets from a radio show to see Earth, Wind & Fire. And I saw them, I'm sure your listeners know who Earth, Wind & Fire is, and I saw them at a Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum on Long Island, and it changed my life, literally. It's that corny statement of, oh, wow, it just changed my life. But it literally
did. It really did.
Yeah, I wanted to be a policeman because I wanted to do something good. But in seeing that show, they were doing it at such a high level. The music was so positive and colorful and had a very strong masculine thing and a very strong feminine thing, too. You know, and it was very well balanced. So standing in the middle of the arena, I had just an epiphany. You know, I could do this. And at the same time, I felt I should do this. And I realized that if I go into law enforcement in any way, I'll be dealing with people after they've either committed a crime or after they've been victimized by a crime. But music is a tool that can guide people away from committing crimes and can certainly limit the amount of people who are victimized by crimes. That's what I felt. And especially,
and all that at the age of like 13 or 14, it just came to you.
I was 14 years old, yeah. And I was lucky, I guess, to have that moment of clarity, you know. So I walked away from that knowing, you know, in the parking lot, knowing I wasn't going to be a cop. I was going to be a musician. And I've been on that quest ever since. I've been doing it ever since.
How'd you choose the bass?
I know how I chose the bass. My brother was interested in bass at the time, and I wanted to do whatever my brother did. So I picked up the bass. We were big Brass Construction fans. It was a big horn bass band, funk band from the 70s. And I saw them on TV one day. My brother was saying, "Wow, how much he loved the bass." And then I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to play the bass." So then he stopped playing the bass.
Now, you come from, we're talking to Brian Hardgrove of Public Enemy and a number of other bands, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. You also come from a very musical and musically involved and passionate family.
Yeah, well, my mother and my father are big music people. As a kid, Sam Cooke was a friend of my mother and my father. He was a close personal friend of my mother and father. And I don't really remember. I mean, I remember activity as a kid, you know, but I vaguely remember any of that any of those people coming through the house. But Jackie Wilson was a friend of my dad's. Tito Puente, my mom and dad, I think, hired Tito to play some shows of theirs. And there was always music in the house, like everybody else's story. And but with my father was very passionate about Tito and Hector Lavoe and, you know, artists like that. And my mother was very big into James Brown, very big into the soul and R&B stuff. And it was just always around. And they never, ever questioned the kind of music I listened to. They were very supportive, and they understood it. I think they dug it. You know, so when I brought Yes albums home and Zeppelin albums home, they could relate to it, you know. So I had a very wide musical experience that I'm really grateful for now, that a lot of folks, a lot of young kids, unfortunately, don't have, you know.
Because of the corporatization of music.
Well, because of radio programming, the corporatization of music, yeah. Record companies have decided to sell as many records as they can and not sell quality, you know. And there's many reasons for that. I don't know how much time we have to get into that. But, you know.
We can, yeah, let's talk about that in a few minutes. I also wanted to ask you, to what extent is hip-hop an originally Latino as well as black phenomenon? It seems like there's a lot of Puerto Rican involvement. Or
yeah, yeah. It's because of where the genre has caught on. You know, places like the South Bronx, a lot of New York communities with a lot of black and Hispanic people living together, you know. And like I said, I wasn't a big fan of the genre for a long time, so I would not even pretend to be an expert. But the involvement is based on a lot of things that blacks and Hispanics are involved in mass, you know, whatever it might be, good or bad, you know. The music is one of them.
Look, we're going to play in just a moment a song by Fine Arts Militia, which is your new group. This is something you're doing in addition to Public Enemy.
Yeah, it's a group I have outside of Public Enemy with Chuck. It's Chuck and myself. We're the Fine Arts Militia, and then this rotating group of musicians. So the record that you'll play is from the first record we did, which had some musicians from back at home, back in New York. Home is Santa Fe now. And the new album is going to be myself, Chuck, and Bootsy Collins.
Is that right?
Paul and Funkadelic, yeah.
Funkadelic. Now, the first song we're going to hear by Fine Arts Militia is Boom Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this song.
Oh, yeah. We were asked to take part in a Martin Scorsese tribute to the blues. And it was a couple of years ago, and it was a documentary that was filmed at Radio City Music Hall. It was directed by Anton Fuqua, Training Day, and it was produced by Martin Scorsese. And we decided to do Boom Boom by John Lee Hooker. We changed the lyrics. Chuck changed the lyrics to No Boom Boom because we were on the cusp of war at that time. And the funny thing about that was you have all of these folks and all this money who are doing this tribute to the blues, had all these legends there. We played just before B.B. King. It was an extraordinary night. But a lot of living legends were performing. And you have all this money in the audience supporting this thing because, yeah, we want to support the blues and blah, blah, blah. But then when we got on and did No Boom Boom, some people's mouths just hit the ground. And it's like, well, wait a minute, we're doing the right thing here because these people are supporting what they see is a museum. But the blues has always been a protest music. And as usual, Chuck D hit it right on the head. You know, we're gonna call this No Boom Boom, No Blowing Up the World. So a few people in the front row who had the big money, their mouths hit the ground. You know, and it was real funny. And then everybody else, 90% of the audience, just went ballistic. You know, so it was a really great night.
Let's take a listen.
1, 2, 3, come on. Push. No, boom, boom, boom. Everybody go boom.
We're talking to Brian Hardgrove, band leader of Public Enemy, leader and producer of Fine Arts Militia, which we just heard a piece of the song. Mm-hmm. Had to cut it off for FC regulation reasons. In the middle, I wasn't able to edit out certain words. But anyway, so this is, I mean, one thing I wanted to talk to you about, of course, this is different from that. This is a tribute to the blues, obvious blues influence there. Hip-hop in general, as you've yourself have said, is musically pretty conservative. Same year to year,
yeah.
Doesn't change. What's that all about?
It's about money. It's about money. And I just want to say to the audience that I'm not a hater on anybody and what they do. I look at... Whatever has access to our children, I look at it critically because it has a negative effect or positive effect down the road. So my critiques of hip hop are based purely on what good it's doing anyone. Okay, so for the most part, hip hop, as pop music and other forms of commercial music over the years have once it's become co-opted by corporate America, its purpose fundamentally changes, you know. And I say hip hop is very conservative because it doesn't change. There are images that videos must incorporate. There are words and topics that the records must incorporate.
In order to sell, in order to get released in the first place on a big label.
In order to get released in the first place. In order to sell, I wouldn't say that because people will buy what they like, but they'll only buy what they have access to. And I say, when you consider the amount of exposure that these artists get these days, those records do not sell well. They don't sell well at all.
So in a way, by being so rigid in terms of musical format, they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The record companies are. The artists are, but they don't know it so much. Because they don't know how the record company plans to market them or how long the record company plans to market them. So what they're going to do is put together something that they believe the label will respond to, and that's using a lot of F words, N words, B words that are titillating to children. If that is titillating to a young person, then they know the label is going to support it, and the label will see how far it goes. Okay, so it doesn't change. Now, when a kid grows out of that and moves on to college, can they listen to that music after a while? Chances are they don't listen to it that much anymore. So you've got to sell it to younger and younger kids. And even if the message doesn't change, and it's somewhat sexual, if you're selling it to younger and younger kids, it's doing more and more damage, you know?
Exactly.
So, yeah. So the labels are extremely... they're on the wrong course. The label's on the wrong... They're making a vital mistake, you know?
Well, and it, you know, the record companies are taking fewer and fewer risks, one hears, because the music industry has gone downhill financially, because people are downloading things and sharing music and all of that stuff. But it seems like it might be a good idea to take more risks, mm-hmm, and actually release stuff that's creative and taking new directions.
Yeah, it would make more sense. Norah Jones is a good example, even though her music is not marketed towards the same age group we're talking about. But I remember sitting with Arif Martin a couple of years ago, who produced Norah Jones. He's passed on now. But he was talking about Norah Jones while I was sitting in his office. He didn't say who she was. I was meeting with him about something else. He didn't say who she was, but he was talking about some artist that was just great, and she was going to just make this incredible record.
Now, this was before her first record came out?
Before her record came out. And at the time, now he's passed away, I guess I can say this, he was just really lamenting about a hit song that was out by Destiny's Child at the time, which is called Survivor. He just said, it's like, I'd rather have a root canal than listen to that song anymore, you know. But Norah Jones's music just shocked everybody because it was good music. And she appealed to a group of people that labels weren't making music for anymore, you know. And so it's not a risk. It's really not a risk. But it's not a risk to invest in someone like her, but the record company executives, like I said, it's a long story, but I'll try to make it focused. The record company executives today, at best, have a revolving door job. And record companies are owned by huge corporations whose initial investment has not been music. So a record company has to provide a certain financial result every quarter. And they don't care what it takes to get that. So we need to sell as many records as fast as possible. So that executive in that revolving door job says, I only have 6 months to show some profit. So I'm not going to invest in an artist that might take me a year to develop. I'm going to invest in the artist that looks and sounds like the artist that sold a million records for my competitor last month. You know, so the risks aren't taken.
And when you think about what it means culturally to stuff music into that frame, it's pretty scary. I mean, music is what gives people their sense of self, their sense of connection to their own lives, to their peers.
Yeah, and because it's so important, it has the potential to make so much money. And when something can make so much money, it gets scooped up as a cash cow by somebody, and that's what it's become.
We're talking to Brian Hardgrove. He's the band leader of Public Enemy, the leader and producer of Fine Arts Militia, and The Band. And he will be taking part in a panel discussion tomorrow night, February 23rd at 7, at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe. The panel is titled Gender, Race, and the New Power Base, the Hip-Hop Generation and Contemporary Politics. It's free, and there's going to be all sorts of interesting people coming to this. It's Brian and several others, including academic hip-hop folks, people from bands, from the music industry, and so on. You said something interesting a little while ago, which was that when you heard Earth, Wind, and Fire, it was incredibly masculine, but there's also a femininity to it. Mm-hmm. I don't hear that in hip-hop. It seems super masculine.
Yeah, super anti-woman. I don't know that I call it masculine, you know, but very anti-woman. A masculine person, a masculine man, you know, in my opinion, is going to be one of the most supportive and protective people, you know, with regard to a woman. So I don't hear, I really don't hear masculinity. I hear aggressiveness.
Yeah. Well, hang on, even in there's aggressiveness, but I mean, even in Public Enemy, where there's a good message.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that it's... I mean, it's just the sound of it, well, whatever the words might be.
Yeah, well, okay, well, yeah. We won't get into the semantics of it, but Public Enemy never had an anti-woman tune. Never, you know. You hear a lot of music today, a lot of hip-hop today that's anti-woman. So these guys come across as incredibly weak to me in that... You know, in that way, you know?
Right?
And it's there's a lot of fear involved. There's all kinds of things, you know. But like I said, I don't make those records, so I don't want to pretend to know what some of these guys are thinking when they do the art. But I know why they turn over what they turn over. They turn it over to the label because they've been convinced that by doing this, I can make money. You know?
You also said a little while ago something which I found interesting and almost perplexing, which is that a lot of rappers, hip-hop people, are not themselves musicians, and they're suspicious of musicians.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's from a personal experience that I've had that constantly repeats itself. There's a... Because a lot of musicians didn't accept hip-hop, or didn't accept rap music, because it's called hip-hop after the fact, but when rap records were being made, it was really spat upon by not just the society at large, or this will never last, but a lot of musicians were like, what is this? That's not music. All you did was sample a record that I made 20 years ago,
right,
and then you started rapping over it. That's not music. So a lot of musicians were very anti-rap for a long time. And a lot of the young rappers, they got that sense. They understood that. And before a lot of guys could afford to buy the record, buy the equipment it takes to make those records back in the days, a lot of them tried to work with musicians, and the musicians would come into the sessions with no respect for those guys. So that was one of the things that attributed to rappers saying, well, I don't want to deal with musicians because they think they know everything and they don't respect what I do, blah, blah, blah. So there's been this disconnect that has been in place ever since and growing. Now you'll have groups like Jay-Z, You know, have an artist like Jay-Z and Public Enemy and a number of other rappers now who have bands now, because some of them have gotten over that. I mean, also some of those bands are run specifically by the producer of the record, who are telling the musicians what to do, and the musicians are still in position now of like saying, these guys don't know what they're talking about. They can't even count to four, but yeah, we'll do it because it pays well. You know, so there is that schism, and I've been having conversations with Herbie Hancock about doing a project to address just that, and to show how that separation has manifested itself in our society at large, where, you know, just young men don't talk to older men because, well, you don't understand me, you don't understand my music, but look how the young men are suffering being disconnected. Look how the young music is suffering from being disconnected from an older foundation. You know.
Well, and the older foundation is so incredibly rich and beautiful and complicated. And so, I mean, it contains, you know, everything from gospel of the early part of the 20th century, you know, up through blues and rock and roll and jazz and, you know, Parliament, Funkadelic and James Brown and Sam Cooke. And there's so much beauty and harmony, melody, romance. It's, you know, rap doesn't contain those things. It's excluded so many of those things.
Yeah, it really has. And as a genre, you know, in defense of rap, as a genre, it never claimed to be harmonic or anything other than what I feel at the moment and what this beat makes me feel like, whatever. But now that it's tried to grow, okay, and you have a combination of, you know, at some point you had like eight bars of rap in every R&B song, you know, a number of years back, because the record companies wanted to get some of that youth excitement and get some of those record sales that the rap genre had. And the rap cats and the labels that had releasing rap records wanted some of that quote-unquote R&B money. So when the two married, and now you have your contemporary hip-hop, it has elements of both consistently, but it still lacks harmonic depth, content, and anything really interesting. And that's because that music is being made by increasingly younger and younger people who don't have the foundation to bring these musical things to it. And that's why I said earlier that with all the exposure that these artists have, and being on MTV or all, you know, whatever video program you think of, they're on 24 hours a day practically, but they still only sell, you know, 2 million records, 3 million records. That's viewed as a success, but when you consider the exposure, that's failure, because that exposure costs a lot of money.
That's right.
And it's not as profitable as it could be, because the music is so paper thin. And once these songs are off the charts, they don't sell anymore. The music does not sell anymore because it doesn't have the depth.
So basically what I hear you saying is, if a record had some depth, somebody would be more willing to shell out $15 for it. But if it doesn't have that depth, they're more likely to go download it.
Yeah, there is some truth to that. Although the download thing is a whole other issue. Let's assume there was no downloading. Let's say that was never an issue. Okay, and say no one could download music. If the music had more depth, the records would sell more throughout the course of a year, the course of 2 years or 3 years. When you see hip-hop or rap compilations now, they're rap records from years ago. You don't see compilations that sell well that may have a Puffy record or a 50 Cent record on it, because those records are... Nobody wants to hear those records after they're off the charts, because those records are about... A Puffy record is about Puffy. A 50 Cent record is about 50 Cent. A Biggie record is about Biggie. Okay?
And it's not about the world. It's not about you, about me.
Yeah. And so therefore, when the world changes, that record is not relevant anymore. Also, because those records are about those individuals, and I'm not picking on those guys, but I'm just mentioning names I know everyone knows. When those records are off the charts again, like I said, no one is going to re-record those songs.
Right.
And I may have mentioned the story to you before, and I tell this to a lot of young folks. In New York City, there's a building called the Bertelsmann Building, which Bertelsmann owns Arista and Jive Records, I believe. And in the lobby of the Bertelsmann building, there's a bust of Elvis Presley. But this is not a bust of Biggie or Puffy, and it will never be, because Elvis's music still sells today and pays for buildings like that, pays for those companies. Hip-hop music today does not have a catalog that's that valuable after it is off the charts. And for example, when Puffy tried to sell Bad Boy some years ago, he wanted like, I think, $100 million for it. He had no takers, not even for half that price, I don't think, because the catalog has no value. Once those records are sold,
right.
Nobody's going to sell them 5 years, and nobody's going to cover those songs.
So what in the world, what in the United States does have that depth that you're talking about now?
Very little. It's, you know, we're talking about hip-hop because of the band that I'm in, but it's a problem, generally speaking. You know, it's a problem, generally speaking. If you look at Rick Rubin, who started Def Jam with Russell Simmons back in the days, Rick Rubin has split off his own company, Def American. I believe it's still called Def American. He worked with Johnny Cash before he passed. He did a record with Neil Diamond. You know, Neil Diamond is one of the greatest songwriters that America has produced, you know, that has worked in America. These guys are just totally discounted, but someone like Rick knows the value of someone like that. And those guys will continue to make records that will have value past the pop charts.
Let's go back to Fine Arts Militia. There's a song that we can play in a moment that you've done, Intelligence Versus Nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about? Tell us a little bit of the background of this song.
That was taken from Chuck's lecture series. He's been doing lectures for a number of years. And when we decided to do a record, he said he wanted to do some songs that touch on each one of his lecture subjects. So Intelligence Versus Nonsense was basically one of those lecture topics, speaking about how a lot of kids today are not encouraged to be intelligent. They're encouraged to just say whatever sounds good, repeat what sounds good, act a certain way, and just continue moving forward in life without getting better or getting smarter. You know, and you listen to the lyrics, you know, he'll say some things about, there's one point where a guy wrote a record where he made a mistake, and instead of saying son, he said done. And he left it in the record because around him, you know, he didn't want to look like he made a mistake in front of his boys. And it ended up being on the record. It was this big ego thing, you know. And so that's basically what the record is about, you know.
Well, let's hear the track Intelligence Versus Nonsense.
When the common people use their senses, that's when it could be called common sense. Check it. Now, sense ain't common. Few got it. Used to be common. Now, few have it. Either you got sense or nonsense. Sense is connected to intelligence. Between intelligence and nonsense is a fence. Since nonsense makes me wince, I'm on some defense. I want intelligence. Come into my defense. Intelligence will save you. In jail, boardrooms, and any school. Intelligence will save you, son. Some cat slipped up and called you dumb. Intelligence will save you, son. Some cat slipped up and called you dumb. Intelligence will save you, son. Some cat slipped up and called you dumb. Now that's three times stupid and stuck on dumb.
We're talking to Brian Hardgrove of Fine Arts Militia, as well as Public Enemy. I know that something you care very deeply about is the responsibility of citizenship, mm-hmm. of being a part of this democracy. Mm-hmm. How does your music fit into that, into teaching that, into putting that message out to young people?
Simply by asking questions. Most of us, it seems, either believe what we're told or ignore anything that's going on that could be uncomfortable. You know, we have a war raging. There are people who've chosen to believe that the president is just going to do the right thing because he's an American. He's going to do the right thing, and that's what we do. We Americans, we do the right thing. We don't do that. We don't torture. We don't do, you know, we don't accept these things. So they'll just believe the president. And then there are people who will say, well, there's nothing I can do because, you know, God is going to handle it, and no matter what I do, it's going to turn out this way. And I think both of those positions, which are just two of many positions that people take, I think both of those positions are irresponsible. As an American citizen, it's my job to make sure that the people around me are responsible to the world. You know, this country is a citizen in the world. So I don't want to get on a long thing about this because it's a very lengthy conversation, but we're not encouraged in school to become citizens. So in my music, what I try to do is bring those points up. And when I say become citizens, we're born as citizens, but we don't partake in the process as people do in many other countries, particularly in newer democracies, you know, quote unquote. Like for Estonia, for example, we were in Estonia a couple of years ago, and it's a very young government, and the kids are very much into what's going on because of their very recent history. It's like, we don't want to go back there, you know. A lot of us who are living today don't know the birth of a nation. We don't know what that is and the pains of that. We're taught it, and we're even taught that history in very revisionist ways,
right.
You know. So we've got to question and look into what has happened, what got us where we are, and take part in the process. I mean, just voting for the presidential election is one thing, but if you don't vote for your sheriff, if you don't vote for your
school board,
if you don't, then you're not affecting the people who affect the president. You know, because we can't access the president, but the people who come from our communities can. You know,
I think it's in the particular moment in time the United States we're living in today, it's tricky business because a lot of people feel that their vote doesn't count. A lot of people feel that their lives are so corporatized that they don't have control over their jobs, their futures.
Yeah.
So what does citizenship mean within that context? What are the actual avenues for, you know, civic expression?
Well, I don't know what they are from town to town. You know, my responsibility is to find out what it is in the town I live in. And that's what I encourage people to do in the towns they live in. And, you know, a lot of people feel their vote doesn't count. Well, a lot of people, it's been proven to them that their vote doesn't count. You know, so what do you do? Do you say, okay, the house is on fire. I didn't start the fire.
Right.
Well, I didn't start it. I'm just going to let it burn. I didn't start it, but you're in it. You're in the house. You've got to figure out why your vote doesn't count. Okay. Don't worry about the screaming chicken heads on the extreme left and the left and the extreme right telling you why your vote didn't count. You need to sort out that those people get paid to do that, to be screaming left and right wing folks. You need to figure out why your vote doesn't count, figure out why it needs to count, and figure out how you need to counter the activities of people that are not counting your vote. I couldn't just sit here and say, well, this is what needs to be done, because it needs to be done different ways in different places. You know, they have a problem in Cincinnati. They have a problem in different counties in Florida. The people who live there have to deal with it. It's no different than us saying, well, we're not going to mess with the Colombians because that's their problem. You know, well, there's some truth to that. The Colombians have to deal with it. The people in Cincinnati, the people in Ohio, the people in Florida, they've got to deal with it. We have, just like corporate radio, okay, you have corporate radio which is programmed from whatever office it is. No matter where you go in the country, it sounds like the same person on the radio. No regional accent, nothing, okay? So we have a couple of voices from key locations across the country telling people in Florida what the problem is and telling everybody else in the world what the problem in Florida is. So you have people in Florida looking at the problem just like other people in the country looking at the problem in Florida. But it's a very specific problem. You've got to be involved. You know, you've got to kick people out of office. You know, you've got to get people out. It's not good enough to...
And get new people in.
Yes, it's not good enough to get a new person in. You've got to get certain people out. There are certain institutions that are in place that need to be questioned and need to be limited, you know.
Now, we've got just a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that we get on to your band called The Band, B-A-N-N-E-D, ladies and gentlemen. Tell us about this band. We're going to hear a song from that as well.
Yeah, the band is literally the backing band for Public Enemy. The musicians, myself, Curry Wynn on guitar, Mike Faulkner is playing drums on this record, Rocky Bryant is the new drummer now, DJ Johnny Juice, and DJ Lord Aswad.
Now, it seems like a very different sound from Public Enemy.
It's a very different sound, but very similar message. We decided to make our own record because we sound good as a group. When we play without Public Enemy before the guys show up, it sounds great. So we decided, to make our own record, and we did. And we bring in the influences that are different influences than Public Enemy. We're all musicians. It has some hip-hop influences, some, but it's basically a rock soul band. And the music we're covering some things in ways that Public Enemy won't cover, you know. Ultimately, on this song, there's no love songs on this record, but there will be on the next record. You know, can you hear Public Enemy doing a love song? Not really.
Not really.
You know? But they're lovers of great love songs, you know. But, you know, they have their fan base. And so, like I said, the band is literally the opening band for the backing band for Public Enemy, and we open up for them on the tours.
Let's hear the tune right now called I'm On Your Side by The Band. We've got so little time left, Brian Hardgrove. That was I'm On Your Side by The Band. I wanted to let people know also, tell us just briefly about a radio program you do. You do a hip-hop program on 101.5.
Well, it's not a hip-hop program. It's called The Fuse Box.
Okay.
I may have played 3 hip-hop songs on that
Oh, is that
program.
Right? I haven't even heard it yet.
Oh, yeah, well, check it out.
Obviously.
Check it out. It's everything. It's everything. I mean, play Ohio Players, play Led Zeppelin, play Little Richard, Tom Jones. It's a very diverse thing. It's called Hard Groove Fuse Box. It's on Saturdays at noon. It rebroadcasts on Wednesdays at Indy 101.5. It's a very exciting thing. It's something I just fell into when I got here.
And you're doing interviews with people as well.
Yeah, I'm doing interviews. Do interviews on that show and another show. I've got 2 shows. The other one is called The Indie Lounge at Stepbridge. But I do interviews on both shows and had some really interesting guests since I've been here. Adrian Ballou, Mark Linkus from Sparkle Horse, Mavis Staples. Really, really interesting lineup.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to go. Maybe we will have you on again one of these days because lots of new creative projects coming up from
pleasure.
Brian Hardgrove, band leader of Public Enemy, leader and producer of the Fine Arts Militia and The Band. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Mary.
And he will be taking part in a panel discussion tomorrow, February 23rd at 7 o'clock at the Forum of the Colleges of Santa Fe, Gender, Race, and the New Power Base, the Hip-Hop Generation and Contemporary Politics. It's free. For more information, 473-6282. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Anita O'Day. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company tomorrow, the inimitable Robert Knott. Hasta la vista. Ciao.